Israel, supremacism through terror. The first obstacle to Zionist objectives was that Britain envisioned a Palestine as portrayed by the Balfour Declaration, a society that would protect the civil and religious rights of all who live there. To dislodge the British, whom the League of Nations had mandated to govern Palestine, the Zionists developed a fine art of terrorism as a modern weapon of political revolution. Menachem Begin, Abraham Stern, Yitzhak Shamir, David Ben-Gurion, and many others began a campaign of bombings and assassinations. They hanged and garroted British soldiers with piano wire and left their mutilated and booby-trapped bodies to be found by the British authorities. Israeli terrorists blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, killing more than 90 people. Their operatives invented the letter bomb technique. Jewish hitmen even assassinated the United Nations mediator in Palestine, Count Folk Bernadotte, because he dared to express concern for the rights of the Palestinians. In his final report to the United Nations before his death, Bernadotte scathingly referred to, quote, Zionist pillage on a grand scale and the destruction of villages without apparent military need. By the way, as a side note, sounds like Lebanon, doesn't it? It would offend basic principles to prevent these innocent victims of the conflict from returning to their homes while Jewish immigrants flood into Palestine, threatening to permanently replace the dispossessed Arab refugees who've been here for centuries. Unquote. The Zionist campaign worked, eventually tiring of the terrorist campaign waged against them and despairing of a world press that covered up these crimes. The British finally threw up their hands and announced their withdrawal from the region. With the British gone, the Zionists could have their way with the native peoples who had dared to live on the land they coveted. No force was left to restrain them. Aided by both the military and financial support of both the capitalist USA and the communist USSR, as well as by the huge sums of money that poured in from Zionist coffers from all over the world, the Jewish blitzkrieg rolled over their enemies as decisively as the biblical account of the Red Sea rolling over the Egyptians. With military victory certain, two significant problems still confronted the Zionists. The first was that there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who obviously would not sit back and let the new Jewish state take away their rights and their lands. Secondly, Palestinians owned more than 93% of the land of the new nation, and that was a serious roadblock to the new Greater Israel. Quoting literally from the book of Joshua, Jewish religious leaders warned that Israel must drive the Palestinians out of their borders. This is from Joshua 23:12-13, else if you do in any wise, go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they to you. Know for certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive these nations from out of your sight, but they shall be a snare and a trap unto you, and a scourge in your sides, and pricks in your eyes, until ye perish off this good land. Unquote. Zionist fanatics ultimately solved their Palestinian problem with mass expulsions, murder, and well-planned intentional terror. What the press refers to in modern times as ethnic cleansing. Palestinians who were born there and whose ancestors had lived there for countless generations were rounded up by the Israeli stormtroopers and driven over the border. Told they could never return to their homes, those expelled had little more than the tattered clothes on their backs. Many who refused to leave their homes were massacred by the Israeli military, and the Zionists publicized the massacres, intentionally causing widespread panic and flight among the Palestinians. Committing atrocities against the Palestinians became an integral part of the Israeli strategy. When Jewish terrorists raped and massacred the residents of Arab villages, those in the surrounding villages naturally gathered up their children and fled for their lives. And that's precisely what the Zionists wanted. Once the Zionists set up their state and secured their initial borders, minus approximately 630,000 pesky Palestinian men, women, and children, the beneficent government of Israel forbade them ever to return to their homes, their businesses, their fields, and their flocks. By the time the Israeli War for Freedom ended, only about 170,000 Palestinians were left within Israel's borders. The Jews, of course, had prominent and powerful spokesmen and supporters all over the world, especially in media, telling of the courage and righteousness of little Israel. By the 1960s, there were millions of adults and children around the world who, like me, were enthralled by the heroic story of Israel, a story romantically retold by the Academy Award-winning movie Exodus. At that time, I, just as most Americans of today, had scant knowledge of the gross injustice committed against the Palestinian people. The most well-known atrocity of the First Israeli War was the massacre of Deir Yassin. On April 9, 1948, after a cessation of fighting in the small village, the Zionist terrorist Irgun gang, led by Menachem Begin, murdered 254 people, most of them women, children, and the elderly. For 2 days, these Zionist terrorists had murdered men, women, and children, raped women, crushed the stomachs of pregnant women, and stolen their possessions. A Red Cross doctor, Jacques de Rainier, chief representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Jerusalem, gave a chilling account of the massacre in his official report. De Rainier arrived at the village on the second day and saw them mopping up, as one of the terrorists called it to him. It had been done with machine guns, then grenades, and was finished off with knives. They decapitated some of the victims and maimed 52 children in the sight of their mothers. The terrorists cut open 25 pregnant women's wombs and butchered the babies in front of them. After his retirement in 1972, Israeli Haganah officer Colonel Meir Piel stated the following about Deir Yassin in Yediot Aharonot, a major Jewish publication. Quote, "The Irgun and Lehi men came out of hiding and began to clean the houses. They shot whoever they saw, women and children included. The commanders did not try to stop the massacre. They were taken to the quarry between Deir Yassin and Givshal and murdered in cold blood. The commander of the Haganah unit that controlled Deir Yassin after the massacre, Zvi Ankori, made this statement in the Israeli newspaper Devar. Quote, "I went into 6 to 7 houses. I saw cut off genitalia and women's crushed stomachs. According to the shooting signs on the bodies, it was direct murder." Albert Einstein, with other concerned Jews, wrote a letter to the New York Times in 1948 decrying Begin as having, quote, "openly preached the doctrine of the fascist state," unquote. He went on to describe Deir Yassin in these words, quote, "On April 9, terrorist bands attacked this peaceful village, which was not a military objective in the fighting, killed most of its inhabitants, 240 men, women, and children, and kept a few of them alive to parade as captives through the streets of Jerusalem. The terrorists, far from being ashamed of their act, were proud of this massacre," unquote. Menachem Begin boasts of the importance of the massacre in Deir Yassin in his book, The Revolt, The Story of the Irgun. He wrote that there would not have been the state of Israel without the victory of Deir Yassin. The Haganah carried out victorious attacks, this is a quote, on other fronts. In a state of terror, the Arabs fled, crying, Deir Yassin. Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, no slouch at Jewish supremacy himself, was quoted at describing Begin with these words, and I quote, "Begin undeniably belongs to the Hitlerian type. He's a racist, ready to destroy all the Arabs in his dream of unification of Israel, prepared to resort to any means to realize this sacred goal," unquote. The instigator of the mass murder, Menachem Begin, later became the Prime Minister of Israel and even received the Nobel Peace Prize. Such an award is symbolic of the incredible worldwide Jewish media power, for Begin had been guilty of crimes not dissimilar to those of the Nazis whom Jews are still hunting and prosecuting today. Alleged crimes of the Nazis, Begin was certainly guilty of exactly the same kinds of alleged crimes, except the difference is perhaps that Begin boasts of these crimes, whereas these other individuals absolutely deny them. Yet, instead of facing trial and punishment for crimes against humanity, Begin received what many would consider the world's highest honor. When I first learned of Deir Yassin, I would recount the Israeli massacres and ask my friends, have you seen any TV documentaries or any Hollywood movies about the Israeli terror of Deir Yassin or of many thousands of other Israeli acts of terror against the Palestinian people? You've heard plenty of violin music for Jewish victims of Hitler, but have you heard any violins for the women at Deir Yassin who had their babies cut from their wombs by Jewish supremacists? In the intervening years, there have been many more terrible acts of Israeli terrorism. Perhaps I can ask the same of those now reading this text. Have you heard any violins, any long and heartfelt documentaries for any of those other thousands of Palestinian victims of Begin, Shamir, Barak, and Sharon? Befitting Israel's long record of terrorism against the Palestinian people, Israel has a nasty habit of electing its most notorious terrorists and mass murderers as heads of state. The United States has a whole division of the Justice Department dedicated to hunting down Nazis who have allegedly committed crimes against humanity, while America doggedly pursues elderly suspected German war criminals. American presidents have state dinners honoring Jewish ones. The massacre at Deir Yassin was not the only one Israeli forces committed. In the May 6, 1992 edition of the Hebrew daily Haaretz, published an article by Guy Ehrlich called Not Only Deir Yassin. That article outlined a pattern of terror and murder. Ehrlich notes the Israeli historian Yair Yitzchaki as saying the following, and I quote, "The time has come," he says, "for a generation has passed, and it's now possible to face the ocean of lies in which we were brought up. In almost every conquered village in the War of Independence, acts were committed which are defined as war crimes, such as indiscriminate killings, massacres, and rapes. I believe that such things end up surfacing. The only question is how to face such evidence." Ehrlich and Yitzchaki point out that Israeli authorities are still covering up the murders, nor did the massacres cease after the establishment of the Jewish state. They continued in times of both peace and war. Following are the names of some of them: Sharafat Massacre, Kibya Massacre, Kafir Qassim Massacre, Al-Shamu Massacre, the Sabra and Shatila Massacre, Orankara Massacre, Al-Aqsa Mosque Massacre, the Abrami Mosque Massacre, the Jubalaya Massacre. There were further killings and expulsions of the Arabs as the Jewish state expanded. In subsequent wars and military incursions, Israel drove more hundreds of thousands of Palestinians into relocation camps. Plagued by hunger and disease, they bore remarkable resemblance to wartime concentration camps. Lebanon also fell victim to Israeli aggression in the 1980s and 90s when it was bombed and invaded. Estimates of civilian casualties in Lebanon exceeded 15,000. The Zionist state also surreptitiously helped create and support rival factions in the Lebanese Civil War, which added tens of thousands to the death toll. The extraordinary diaries of Moshe Sheret, who had once shared the prime ministership of Israel with David Ben-Gurion, reveal Israel's treachery in the Lebanese Civil War. Sheret had been forced out of the cabinet because he would not go along with what he felt were Ben-Gurion's clandestine and immoral actions. After Sheret's death, His son published the diaries despite a long battle of intimidation and legal maneuvers by the Zionists. Jewish author Livia Rokash quotes Sherrett's diaries in her book, Israel's Sacred Terrorism. The diaries reveal how Israel purposefully created the Lebanese Civil War to further Israel's imperialist ambitions. In May 1955, passages in the book, Sherrett describes Israel's plans to destabilize Lebanon's government, a plan that eventually produced the 1978 Lebanese War. Sherrett quotes Moshe Dayan, Ben-Gurion's defense minister, at a secret cabinet meeting on May 16th, planning to foment Lebanese civil war as an excuse for Israel to go in and annex land with water rights to the Litani River. In the first invasion of Lebanon in 1982, 10,000 civilians died and one half of a million people were driven from their homes. In the course of the fighting, Israeli forces devastated the city of Beirut, which before the war was described as the Garden City of the Mideast. During the Israeli invasion, the USS New Jersey, sitting offshore, fired shells into some of the Lebanese towns. The U.S. involvement in Israel's 1982 war destroyed what little credibility America had left in the Mideast and cost our taxpayers billions. It also cost the lives of 241 U.S. Marines. More than 1,500 women, children, and elderly people were butchered in the Sabra and Shatila refugee centers under the watchful eyes of the Israeli invaders. And as a side note, as you know, Israel's recent invasion of Lebanon has killed at least 1,200 to 1,300 civilians, many of them children and women. Civilians, in fact, most of them were civilians, whereas the death toll from the Hezbollah rockets and other activities were primarily Israeli military. The bombing of Beirut and the wholesale bombing of the entire country caused misery to millions and millions of people, and tens of thousands of homes where families live were destroyed, and many, many thousands were wounded and scarred and damaged for life. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is one of the world's most bloodstained terrorists. And when this book was written, he was Prime Minister. He is, of course, not now. He's still in a coma. He may be soon to pass. But that doesn't excuse and that doesn't change the fact of his terrorist record. He's responsible for the cold-blooded slaughter of at least 1,500 men, women, and children in the Beirut refugee camps of Shatila and Sabra. Even a formal Israeli commission found Sharon personally responsible for the Lebanese massacres. In 1982, as Israel's defense minister, Sharon directed Israel's invasion of Lebanon and the carpet bombing and devastation of the city of Beirut. In Lebanon, four times more women and children died than in the September New York attack. Now, this terror bombing was carried out by Jews using jet fighters and bombs supplied by the United States. After the Israeli military devastation and occupation, Sharon forcibly removed Palestinian resistance fighters from Lebanon. Many Palestinian women, children, and old people were left behind in refugee camps near Beirut. The United States publicly guaranteed their safety and promised that they would quickly be reunited with their loved ones. When Sharon plotted their murder, he knew that he planned a bloody act of terrorism against the refugees, and he knew it was an act of treachery against the United States, one that would raise intense hatred against America. On the night of September 16, 1982, Sharon sent phalangist murdering squads into two Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila. With Israeli tanks and troops surrounding the camps closely to prevent any of the Palestinians from escaping, the murder squads machine-gunned, bayoneted, and bludgeoned Palestinian civilians all that night. The screams were heard all night. The next day and the following night, all happened while the Israelis surrounded the camps, and they simply listened gleefully to the machine-gun fire and screams coming from inside. Sharon then sent in bulldozers to hide as much of the atrocity as he could. At least 1,500 Palestinian men, women, and children were butchered, and perhaps as many as 2,500. An official Lebanese investigation put the figure at 2,500. Even after the efforts of Sharon's bulldozers, many Palestinians remained unburied, and Red Cross workers found whole families, including hundreds of elderly and little children, with their throats cut or disemboweled. Uncounted numbers of women and girls were also raped before they were slaughtered. Errol Sharon was sought for trial by a Belgium court for crimes against humanity, much like the way the Hague Tribunal succeeded in extraditing former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic for crimes against humanity in Kosovo. On a technicality, the effort was first blocked by a high court in Belgium, but now it was on again and finally off again. And since the inquiry was initiated by Belgium, a number of potential witnesses hostile to Sharon have been assassinated. Although he was sought for his Shatila and Sabra murders, Sharon could have been tried for any dozen of a number of other massacres committed during his sterling career. Crimes against humanity that go back at least as far as 1953. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz recalls Sharon's leading of a massacre in the village of Kipya, 1953. The soldiers of Major Errol Sharon killed 70 Palestinians in the reprisal raid, most of them women and children. Unquote. Israel's murder of the Palestinian refugees after the United States had publicly guaranteed their safety in Sabra and Shatila was not only a crime against humanity, but also one of treachery against America. Sharon and the others involved were completely aware of America's well-publicized promise of the refugee safety. It was certainly that betrayal which led to one of the worst acts of terrorism in American history. The Beirut Sabra and Shatila massacre formed the chief motivation of the Lebanese suicide bombing attack that killed 241 American Marines in Beirut less than a year later, and it clearly demonstrates how American support of Israeli terrorism leads to terrible consequences for our country. The Los Angeles Times, in discussing a revealing book by a former agent of the Israeli Mossad, Secret Service, showed that the Mossad had foreknowledge of the terrorist attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983, but treacherously did not warn America. And here's a quote. Among Ostrovsky's more shocking allegations are that the Mossad failed to share with the U.S. detailed intelligence that might have averted the 1983 suicide bombing of the Beirut Marine barracks that killed 241 U.S. servicemen. Our more recent massacre was at Qana, a small town in southern Lebanon. Here are some excerpts of a British journalist's eyewitness account of the action so that the reader can fully understand that behind the cold statistics are real people. People who have faced a horror no less real than those who were murdered in the World Trade Center bombing. And this is a quotation directly from Robert Fisk, his article for the London Independent. Qana, southern Lebanon, it was a massacre. Not since Sabra and Shatila had I seen the innocent slaughtered like this. The Lebanese refugee women and children and men lay in heaps, their hands or arms or legs missing, beheaded or disemboweled. There were well over 100 of them. A baby lay without a head. The Israeli shells had scythed through them as they lay in the United Nations shelter, believing that they were safe under the world's protection. Like the Muslims of Srebrenica, the Muslims of Qana were wrong. In front of a building burning of the UN's Fijian battalion headquarters, a girl held a corpse in her arms, the body of a gray-haired man whose eyes were staring at her as she rocked the corpse back and forth in her arms, keening and weeping and crying the same words over and over, "My father, my father." A Fijian United Nations soldier stood amid a sea of bodies and, without saying a word, held aloft the body of a headless child. When I walked toward them, I slipped on a human hand. Israel's slaughter of civilians in this terrible 10-day offensive, 206 by last night, has been so cavalier, so ferocious, that not a Lebanese will forgive this massacre. There had been the ambulance attacked on Saturday, the sisters killed in Yamour the day before, the two-year-old girl decapitated by an Israeli missile 4 days ago. And earlier yesterday, the Israelis had slaughtered a family of 12. The youngest was a four-day-old baby when Israeli helicopter pilots fired missiles into their home. Shortly afterwards, three Israeli jets dropped bombs only 250 meters from a United Nations convoy on which I was traveling, blasting a house 30 feet into the air in front of my eyes. Traveling back to Beirut to file my report on the Khana massacre to the Independent last night, I found two Israeli gunboats firing at the civilian cars on the river bridge north of Sidon. A French UN trooper muttered oaths to himself as he opened a bag in which he was dropping feet, fingers, pieces of people's arms. We had suddenly become not UN troops and journalists, but Westerners, Israelis, allies, an object of hatred and venom. One bearded man with fierce eyes stared at us, his face dark with fury. "You are Americans," he screamed at us. "Americans are dogs. You did this. Americans are dogs." President Bill Clinton has allied himself with Israel in its war against, quote, terrorism in the Lebanese. In their grief, had not forgotten this. Israel's official expression of sorrow was rubbing salt in their wounds. Quote, "I would like to be made into a bomb and blow myself up amid the Israelis," one old man said. Unquote. Unlike the bloody scenes of the aftermath of Palestinian suicide bombers in Israel, Americans and Europeans never saw the butchery that Fisk describes. The media very seldom draw our attention to sufferings inflicted by Jews. It is suffering inflicted on Jews that they focus on. Those who wear the six-pointed star and who bomb United Nations shelters, ambulances, civilian refugee camps, and civilian automobiles are never described as terrorists. They are simply referred to as commandos or simply military forces. In contrast, Palestinian fighters outside the borders of Israel are, of course, routinely described as terrorists. And as a side note, of course, this is how Hezbollah got its start, from the incredible terrorism and violence and murder of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Now, the remarks of the old man at Khana that he would like to be made into a bomb and blow himself up amid the Israelis proved tragically prophetic. For just a year and a half later, a number of Palestinians, desperate to exact revenge, sacrificed their lives to do just that in Jerusalem marketplaces. Since that time, dozens have done so in intervening years. No one can defend any acts that kill or maim the innocent, but it's important to understand the horror that has induced hundreds of Palestinians to sacrifice their own lives to strike their feeble blows at those who have murdered their loved ones and stolen their homeland. In their grief and rage, they also commit acts of violence against the innocent. The Zionist leaders also know full well that such Jewish losses, stroked relentlessly by the media, airing the blood-splashed videos around the world, only increases Jewish solidarity and augments non-Jewish sympathy for the eternally suffering Jewish people. When Saddam Hussein tried to take back Kuwait, which had once been part of Iraq, the Western world went to war, encouraged to do so, most notably by Israel. Were Iraq's actions any more imperialistic than Israel's against the Palestinians or against the Lebanese? Israel still occupies the West Bank, and they still imprison Gaza. They occupy part of the Golan Heights in violation of United Nations resolutions, which have also been approved by the United States of America. Other than the scale of the conflict, what is the difference between Israel's perpetual wars of conquest compared to Nazi Germany seeking Lebensraum in the 1940s? Germany treated no nations any worse than Israel did Palestine, with its terrorizing and driving out three-fourths of its Palestinian residents. No populations of any European nation other than those in some of the Soviet-occupied sectors of Germany have been so massively displaced. It is interesting to note that Jews also directed the terror against the Germans as well, but in that war, they wore the uniform of the Soviet commissars rather than that of the terrorist Stern Gang or Haganah. Within the borders of Israel and our occupied territories, under the heel of a harsh military occupation, Israel continues to expropriate land from the Palestinians, settlement by settlement. Naturally, the Palestinians resist such confiscation. The greatest uprising in recent years was the Intifada. The statistics of Palestinian casualties are ominous. Here are the figures compiled by the major French magazine Le Monde. 1,116 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the Intifada, stone-throwing revolt, on 9 December 1987, shot by soldiers, policemen, or settlers. The figures break down as follows. 626 deaths in 1988 and 89, 134 in 1990, 93 in 1991, 108 in 1992, 155 from January 1st to September 11, 1993. Among the victims were 233 children under 17 years old, according to a study carried out by B'Tselem, the Israeli Association for Human Rights. Military sources give the figure of nearly 20,000 for the number of Palestinians wounded by bullets. And the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, gives the figure of 90,000. This humanitarian organization also indicates that at least 20,000 detainees are tortured every year during interrogation in the military detention centers. Unquote. No country in peacetime, not even the Soviets or the Red Chinese in the heyday of their gulags, has held as many prisoners per capita as the nation of Israel. It's one of the few nations that will not officially renounce the use of torture. It has long been high on the list of the offenders compiled by Amnesty International. The London Times magazine did an extensive expose on Israeli torture in the 1970s, the 1980s, and 1990s. The inescapable fact is that Israel was born and built by invasion, murder, and theft, and such injustice requires the use of force and terror to maintain its power. Since 1948, Palestinians have faced ongoing terrorism from Israel. Hundreds of villages have been obliterated and literally wiped from the map. Tens of thousands of homes have been bombed, bulldozed, or dynamited during peacetime. Tens of thousands of men, women, and children have been killed. Even greater numbers have been blinded, crippled, disfigured, and maimed. Hundreds of thousands have been imprisoned and/or tortured. In going after Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation, Israel has never been shy about bombing refugee camps full of women and children. Israeli tanks, helicopters, even jet fighters are used to drop bombs or foul missiles into the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods and refugee camps packed with women and children. These weapons cannot discriminate between a supposed terrorist and an 8-year-old little girl. Such a weapon kills children as surely as it kills enemies of the state. Palestinians suspected of actively opposing Israel's occupation of the West Bank or Gaza have had their homes and families attacked by Israeli tank cannons, missiles, or bombs, and after their suspect is killed or imprisoned, the Israeli army bulldozers or dynamites their families' homes. Thousands of homes have been destroyed in this fashion. Israel has also killed hundreds of Palestinian leaders by assassination and terroristic attacks. These attacks often kill innocent bystanders. Many of those assassinated have never been associated with any terror or violence of any kind. They simply were poets, writers, or clerics who by their words have inspired in their countrymen the desire for freedom. The Israeli prime minister previous to Ariel Sharon was Ehud Barak. In 1972, during peacetime between Israel and Lebanon, he led an Israeli commando death squad into Beirut, Lebanon, where he personally murdered a Palestinian writer, Kamal Adwan. In the middle of the night, using silenced machine guns, he and his team slaughtered Adwan. The newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak came to New York and Washington. The Jewish-controlled press treated this murderer as a conquering hero. The double standards never seemed to end. When an Israeli cabinet official, Rekfam Zevi, was assassinated by Palestinians in October of 2001, Sharon and some of his U.S. officials denounced it as, quote, terrorism. If the shooting down of Zevi is indeed terrorism, what should we call many years of Israeli assassinations of hundreds of Palestinian political figures, philosophers, clerics, and poets? Why doesn't the press point out that Zevi himself was a Jewish supremacist who described Palestinians living and working illegally in Israel as, quote, lice and a cancer in our midst? Zeidi himself obviously was an extreme Jewish supremacist and terrorist who advocated the forcible expulsion of all Palestinians from the occupied territories and the assassination of all those who resist Israeli occupation. He even publicly called for the assassination of Yasser Arafat. Yet the same press that called Zeevi's assassination terrorism never called the pro-assassination Zeevi a terrorist or even a Jewish supremacist. The Zeevi assassination itself was in direct response to the Israeli assassination of a Palestinian leader a few weeks before. In 1991, at an Israeli cabinet meeting, Zeevi said that President George Bush, by pressing Israel to peace talks, was, quote, an enemy of Israel, and that, quote, America was plotting a second Holocaust. With a supposed ally like this, does America need any enemies? The overwhelming power of the Jewish partisans in the world media keeps many people from fully grasping the terror of hundreds of Israeli assassinations. In fact, even before the World Trade Center terror attack in September, the BBC instructed their reporters to call Israel's assassination of their enemies, quote, targeted killings, rather than exactly what they were, assassinations. However, the BBC, which has a disproportionately Jewish executive staff, referred to the Zeevi killing as an assassination and not as a, quote, targeted killing. The public has been subjected to this kind of sanitized and distorted media treatment of Israel for years. It's no wonder why few Britons and even fewer Americans are fully aware of Israel's record of terrorism. It is for this reason that I cannot blame most Americans for their ignorance of Israeli terrorism. And this section is at least 150,000 Palestinians tortured in Israel. The brutal torture of thousands of one's enemies must be classified as a particularly vicious form of terrorism. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been tortured in Israeli jails. A Jewish human rights group in Israel confirmed in a 60-page report that 85% of Palestinian detainees undergo torture while in custody. And make no mistake about it, many of these tortures endured by these Palestinian victims are the stuff of one's worst nightmares. Israeli torture includes everything from choking victims with urine and feces-soaked bags tied over their heads to using electric cattle prods for anal rape and mutilation. Israel often doesn't even admit who they are holding, so if they decide to kill or torture a Palestinian to death while he's in custody, his body will simply disappear. They will later claim that they died in a battle with Israeli police before capture. Many thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese have died while in Israeli custody. A feature article by Joel Greenberg in the very pro-Israel New York Times stated matter-of-factly that Israel tortures 500 to 600 Palestinians every month. That figure, which is probably too low as it comes from the pro-Israel New York Times, means that each year at least 6,000 Palestinians are tortured in Israel. Torture of Palestinians has been going on in Israel since 1948. Even if one uses just one half of the number of Palestinians that Mr. Greenberg says suffer torture each year, at least 150,000 human beings have been tortured in Israeli jails since the founding of the Israeli state, and likely the numbers are a lot higher. Bowing to Israel's public relations problems because of its legalized torture, in 1999, the Israeli Supreme Court made an intentionally vague ruling that torture is sometimes illegal. But both Israeli and Palestinian rights groups offer much evidence that the ruling is just a public relations veneer. They offer evidence that torture continues with the same frequency and brutality as it did before the ruling. Following Israel's lead, Jewish journalists are now beginning to advocate the use of torture in America. A recent issue of Newsweek headlined an article entitled, Time to Think About Torture. It's a new world, and survival may well require old techniques that seemed out of the question, unquote. Even a supposed Jewish champion of civil liberties, Alan Dershowitz, now advocates torture. Victor Ostrovsky, a former Israeli Mossad agent, wrote two books about Israel's terror against their enemies. In one of them, he discusses the fate of Palestinians who illegally cross the border in search of work in Israel. Many thousands of these young men simply are never heard from again after being captured by Israeli forces. Some of them are taken to the ABC research facilities where they endure the indescribable horror of chemical, nuclear, or biological weapons testing. And here's a direct quote from Victor Ostrowski, former Mossad agent. ABC, standing for Atomic, Bacterial, and Chemical, it was where our top epidemiological scientists were developing various doomsday machines. Should there be an all-out war in which this type of weapon would be needed, there was no room for error. The Palestinian infiltrators came in handy in this regard. As human guinea pigs, they could make sure the weapons the scientists were developing worked properly and could verify how fast they worked and make them more Israeli weapons of terror. In the early 1990s, there was a traveling roadshow of U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Defense Secretary William Cohen, and National Security Chairman Sandy Berger. This trio of Jewish partisans appeared together in speeches and on television programs to promote their renewed bombing of Iraq and their enforced blockading of the country, including food and medicine. The rationale was that Iraq had violated United Nations resolutions because it dared to do research into development of chemical and biological weapons, and that it refused international inspections. Albright, Cohen, and other leading American Zionists effectively bullied the United Nations into supporting these draconian sanctions. Within a few years, the blockade had taken a horrendous toll of life in the Desert Kingdom that has little production of food and medical products. The same United Nations that had authorized the sanctions estimated that over 1.1 million people, mainly children and the elderly, had perished from the effects of widespread malnutrition, starvation, and lack of medical supplies. In perhaps one of the most callous remarks ever made by a United States government official, Madeleine Albright, in response to a journalist's question, she said, quote, "Such a loss of life was worth it. Some Americans reading my words will refuse to believe it. They'll refuse to believe that America, under our Jewish-influenced leadership, has purposely caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children." But here is the transcript of the interview of America's Jewish Secretary of State with Leslie Stahl of CBS on May 11, 1996. Quote, Leslie Stahl, speaking of U.S. sanctions against Iraq, quote, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?" And Madeleine Albright answers, this is straight from the transcript, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." The readily acknowledged fact is that Israel has been one of the world's worst offenders in the development of internationally prohibited nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. They have repeatedly violated United Nations international policies, and they've never allowed any sort of international inspection of their facilities, not even from the United States, the nation that has certainly provided most of the military funding that Israel has used for such projects. Does the United States call for the blockade of Israel for such offenses? Does it make billions of dollars of American military aid to Israel contingent on Israeli honoring its commitments not to develop biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons? The former American Secretary of State said that she's willing to cause the death of 500,000 children in order to slow the spread of biological and chemical weapons, but she was just as willing to continue to help finance the development and spread of those kinds of horrendous weapons in Israel. Is it any wonder why such double standards and increasing hatred exist toward the United States of America? And as a side note, Israel itself had violated United Nations resolutions and continues to violate them all the way from the time of 1967 when they invaded the West Bank of Palestine and they proceeded to confiscate and steal the land from the Palestinians who live there. The United Nations resolution demands, which was also, by the way, supported by the United States of America at the time, demands that Israel vacate the lands that they occupy on the West Bank. Israel still hasn't. But we have not done any blockade of Israel of food and medicine. We've not caused any Israeli lives. No, on the opposite hand, we've actually given them more weapons, even though they're occupying another people's country and stealing their land and also committing all kinds of horrendous human rights violations, like throwing tens of thousands of people each year in prison and torturing them. The next section is the ultimate supremacist terror weapon. The unholy marriage of Jewish supremacism and terrorism is best symbolized by an entirely new kind of weapon now under development in the supremacist state of Israel. It's an ethnically targeted biological bomb. The Sunday Times in Great Britain revealed that Israel has been developing a terrifying new kind of biological weapon. The story broke at the same time America was getting ready to bomb Saddam Hussein for not allowing weapons inspectors into his country. The headline is Israel Planning Ethnic Bomb as Saddam Caves In by Yuzi Manimi and Mary Colvin. Israel is working on a biological weapon that would harm Arabs but not Jews, according to Israeli military and Western intelligence sources. The weapon, targeting victims of ethnic origin, is seen as Israel's response to Iraq's threat of chemical and biological attacks. Again, of course, chemical and biological attacks. We know now Iraq had no chemical weapons at all. Not only did the inspectors find none, this is a side note, but the United States government spent about $1 billion, believe it or not, that much money to justify the war, I guess, searching for them in Iraq, and they found not a trace. Anyway, I'll go on. Yesterday, Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi leader, backed away from the brink of war and agreed to resume cooperation with the inspection teams seeking his suspected chemical and biological weapons plants. Kofi Annan, the United Nations Secretary General, said he believed Iraq had met UN requirements as Britain and America stood by to bomb Saddam. However, Tony Blair's office said compliance must be unconditional. The White House, which is threatening Iraq with the biggest onslaught since the Gulf War, said President Bill Clinton's advisors were assessing whether Iraq's offer was adequate. The Pentagon is ready to bomb within days. In developing their ethnobomb, Israeli scientists are trying to exploit medical advances by identifying distinctive genes carried by some Arabs and then create a genetically modified bacterium or virus. The intention is to use the ability of viruses and certain bacteria to alter the DNA inside their host's living cells. The scientists are trying to engineer deadly microorganisms that attack only those bearing the distinctive genes. The program is based at the Biological Institute in the Nez Tijona, the main research facility for Israel's clandestine arsenal of chemical and biological weapons. A scientist there said the task was usually complicated because both Arabs and Jews are of Semitic origin, but he added they have, however, succeeded in pinpointing a particular characteristic in the genetic profile of certain Arab communities, particularly the Iraqi people. The disease could be spread by spraying the organisms in the air or putting them in water supplies. Now, the idea of a Jewish state, this is continuing with the quote directly from this major newspaper, in fact, one of the premier newspapers in the world, the Sunday Times of London. The idea of a Jewish state conducting such research has already provoked outrage in some quarters because of parallels with the genetic experiments of Dr. Joseph Mengele, the Nazi scientist at Auschwitz. Didi Zucker, member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, denounced the research yesterday. Morally, based on our history and our tradition and our experience, such a weapon is monstrous and should be denied, he said. William Cohen, the American Defense Secretary, revealed that he had received reports of countries working to create a certain type of pathogens that would be ethnic-specific. A senior Western intelligence source confirmed last week that Israel was one of the countries Cohen had in mind. The ethnobomb claims to have been given further credence in the Foreign Report, a Jane's publication that closely monitors security and defense matters. It reports unnamed South African sources as saying Israeli scientists have used some of the South African research in trying to develop an ethnic bullet against Arabs. It also says Israelis discovered aspects of the Arab genetic makeup by researching on Jews of Arab origin, especially Iraqis. Additional reporting, Matthew Campbell in Washington, U. McManners. Unquote. Israel, of course, has denied the story that appeared in one of the most respected newspapers of the world, just as it denies every other criticism against them. But tellingly, it also continues to deny any access or inspections of its weapons facilities, including those biological weapons facilities the United States has already identified and has acknowledged in the Israeli state. The fact that Israel would even consider developing such a biological weapon in the light of the endless demonization of the Nazis has monstrous implications. Whether or not the Nazis are truly guilty of all the accusations the Jews have levied against them, the Israel of the 21st century is approaching in reality the extremes of racial supremacism of which the most supremacist Nazi could have only dreamt. In the wake of this attacks on the World Trade Center and of the Pentagon in September of 2001, the United States declared a new war on terrorism. Many millions around the world who know the truth about Israeli terrorism were shocked to see the American President George Bush learning how to fight terrorism from Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. It is certainly true that Sharon should be able to teach Mr. Bush a lot about terrorism, considering that he's the world's leading terrorist. At least Mr. Bush has sought expert advice. While Zionists in Israel were dispossessing the Palestinians, Zionists in America were busy consolidating their power in all the Western nations, also promoting policies that would weaken the identity and the will for self-preservation of the founding Gentile elements of those nations. They'd even set about to make us a minority in our nation, just as they made the Palestinians a minority in Israel. I knew that if the Zionists succeeded in their ultimate objectives, they would destroy our own people's life and liberty, just as they had oppressed millions in the Mideast. The structure and form of modern Israel proves that Jewish supremacism is not an ideology of the past, but an ominous reality of the present, overtly expressed in every sinew of the Israeli state. The fact that the Jewish power structure in America and around the world intensely supports Israel offers convincing evidence that little had changed in the struggle between Jew and Gentile over the last 2,500 years. Moreover, the fact that Jews have been able to get the Western world to support Zionism and all of its bloody hypocrisy is testimony to their power over all forms of media and over our nation's governments. The European and American peoples, the Palestinians, indeed all the peoples of the world cannot survive, nor can they be free unless that power is broken. Jewish supremacism and Jewish terrorism have, of course, gone hand in hand from the days of the genocide boasted about in the Old Testament, to the brutal murder and suppression of early Christians recorded in the New Testament, to the mass murder and torture of the gulags of the early days of Jewish-led Bolshevism, and of course to the founding and expansion of the Jewish supremacist state of Israel. But up until a summer day in 1967, I never dreamed that my own country could be the recipient of Jewish terrorism. It seemed far away, a faraway phenomenon not really applicable to America. In 1967, Israel launched a deliberate, murderous terror attack against the American Navy ship, the USS Liberty. Learning the sordid details of the attack against my own nation and its subsequent cover-up had a profound effect upon the direction of my life, ultimately even playing an important role in influencing me to continue my research into Jewish supremacism. I was impassioned to expose it, even though I knew that doing so would probably exact a high personal cost. My learning about Israeli terrorism against America was one of the major reasons that you now hold this book in your hands. And now I will turn to the details of this Israeli act of treachery that so appalled me.